Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking to someone who's sort of in an agricultural school, but not dealing with agriculture, but dealing with animals. So we're going to be talking to someone who's a specialist in companion animals. And Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio a member of the faculty at NMSU, Gaylene Fasenko. And she's working in the animal and range science studies there, and she's going to tell us about these animals.
So, Gaylene, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, we're looking forward to this. But before we get into companion animals and things of this nature, take us back to the beginning of Gaylene as a scientist. What were those little moments that you realized, you know, this is a career that I think I want?
Well, as a youngster, I started out either wanting to be a marine biologist, which my daughter now, who's 10, is saying that she wants to do, or a veterinarian, or some. I always knew I wanted to work with animals. I have a great affinity towards and passion for animals, and I always knew I wanted to work with animals in some capacity. And one of my earliest memories is I loved watching the National Geographic shows on TV. And when I was a youngster, I thought those people had the coolest jobs ever. They got to travel all over the world studying animals.
But there's only four of them.
Yes, of course. Now I do. But now I also realize that they no longer have the coolest jobs in the world. I'm living the dream, and I have the coolest job in the world.
Well, so tell us then, once you decided that area, how did you plan your career? How did you plan your education?
Well, my education started out because I thought originally when I was a youngster, as many young people do, that there was only really one path if you wanted to work with animals, and that was to be a veterinarian. And now, you know, that I'm working in this field, I realize there's so many more opportunities than just being a veterinarian, although that is certainly a wonderful calling. But so I started out in a agriculture department, and I got my Bachelor of Science in Animal Science. And along the way, I decided and realized that it was a hard job to be a veterinarian. I didn't know whether or not I could handle working with sick animals and having the difficult decision of helping them pass on and euthanize them. So I changed my ways and kind of fell into research and decided I had a real affinity for it and a love for it. And the first research projects that I was doing was on bird incubation, so incubating eggs and trying to determine what helps them hatch and why some don't hatch. And so then I did my master's, and then I went on to do my PhD in the same area.
Well, which schools did you go to?
Yes, I'm a Canadian, and I started out at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and that's where I got both my bachelor's in animal science and my master's in animal reproduction. And then from there, I realized there was very few people working in the area of bird incubation, which scientists call avian embryology. And the one person, one of the people that was an expert in the area was at North Carolina State University. So I did my PhD in animal physiology at North Carolina State. And that's also where I got my friends joke that I got my MRS, my missus there, because I met my husband in North Carolina as well.
Good. Before we get into then the companion animal, let's just revisit just a little bit what you did with avian embryology. You know, there was that famous book in the 60s or 70s, Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, and that was all about, you know, the potential of the doing harm of DDT and making eggshells less robust, more fragile, and therefore really destroying a sort of a generation of birds. Could you sort of recap that and tell us what was correct about that, what was incorrect?
Well, certainly the chemical DDT did reduce the shell quality of wild species. I worked mostly on domestic species, so chickens and turkeys, but it did put in jeopardy many of our wildlife species. And, you know, the reduction and, I guess, in some cases, the banning of DDT has helped. And the recognition, this is what scientists do. We recognize a problem, and then we work to deal with it. And so that's what I like. I just talked to my daughter's class yesterday at her school, and that's what's so cool about being a scientist is we see a problem, we work to solve it, and we do our best to solve it and to understand why. I drive my kids crazy because I'm always asking them why.
Well, why? I mean, I want to ask you the same question then. Why did DDT have that impact?
Like I said, I don't really work in that field, but the impact had to do with, I believe, the physiology of eggshell production and calcium deposition on the eggshell. But beyond that, I really couldn't tell you.
Just before we leave this avian embryology, what was the sort of the most interesting discovery that you and your graduate students made? What was the one sort of big paper, the one interesting discovery?
Oh, I don't know. There was quite a few. I had more than five grad students, but at the time that I left my program, I had five grad students. I guess sometimes the simplest, you know, when we are, as a researcher, when we're researching one topic and another topic comes up and is very frustrating and it leads us down a different path, that's what makes research exciting. And one of the areas that I hadn't really been trained in was on sperm physiology. And so when I left, one of my grad students was looking at sperm physiology. And birds are really interesting creatures because they can actually store sperm for in the domestic species, in turkeys, they can store sperm from anywhere from 2 weeks to a month, and it would still be viable and able to fertilize an egg. But one of the things that we were researching is that even though it can fertilize an egg and produce offspring, the likelihood of that happening was reduced. So the embryos weren't surviving, and so that's one of the areas that we were investigating.
So a stored sperm loses some of its potency and viability for reproduction.
Precisely. And the other very interesting thing about the storage of sperm in the female is that they have structures inside the female's reproductive tract called sperm storage tubules. And I used to explain it to my students, they're like sperm parking lots. And only the elite of sperm could enter these parking lots. So if you were a BMW of sperm or a Jaguar, you could get a prime spot. But if you were a beat-up Buick, you might not get into a parking lot. So
Wait. This is interesting. Is there a parking attendant or what? I mean, what's the regulation of that?
That's the big question that some scientists are trying to figure out is how does the female bird decide which sperm gets to enter and which don't? And there are still many questions that remain unanswered in the area of bird reproduction.
For all its fascination, though, you opted out in order to come down to New Mexico State and get into this business of companion animals. Tell us, you know, what was in that decision, apart from just the joy of having an animal. Do you have animals?
Oh, yes. I am in my office right now, and I have my guinea pig and my chinchilla. I say my. I always tell my husband, you know, we should buy these things for the kids. But secretly, yeah, they're for me. And we also have two dogs as well. And I'm a terrier person. I'm a little woman, and but my husband says I'm small but mean, so he doesn't worry about me when he has to leave me at home. When I was up in Alberta and a researcher in avian incubation and embryology, I was asked to start teaching a companion animal course. And for those people, for those listeners that don't know what a companion animal is, well, it's just a fancy way of saying our pets. Now we refer to them as companion animals, but when I was growing up as a kid, they were pets. So dogs, cats, guinea pigs. Now we have people that refer to their snakes and their lizards and birds as companion animals as well. But I started teaching this class, and I have always, always had a special place in my heart for dogs in particular. So the reason I was asked to teach the class is because at the time, I was the logical choice, I guess, because I was taking one of my dogs to the children's hospital to visit the sick kids, and our department head knew that I had an affinity for dogs and decided that I would be the best choice, and I jumped at the chance.
Let's talk about companion animals then. I mean, there's a therapy, a whole industry, I believe, in animals, you know, prolonging people's lives, making the quality of their lives better. Discuss that a little bit for us.
Certainly. Well, when I came down to New Mexico State University and I started, they had one companion animal class, and since then I have developed four more. And one of them is a very well-prescribed, well-attended class called Companion Animals and the Human-Animal Bond. And in that class, we talk about everything. I always warn my students at the beginning of the class because I think they enter into the class thinking that we're just going to be talking about warm and fuzzy things, and we are. We talk about the very beneficial effects of companion animals. You know, recently we had the tragedy in Connecticut, and there were therapy animals visiting there to try and help soothe people's emotions and get them through this horrible event. But the other thing we talk about is I have a colleague that is director of the Student Counseling Center, and she comes in and talks about things such as animal hoarding and the link between human abuse and animal abuse.
You need to tell our listeners what animal hoarding means.
Certainly. Well, animal hoarding is, in fact, there's a show on TV about animal hoarders. And so many times what these people do is they will collect, basically, animals. Just as you see people who collect things and end up having very cluttered homes because they cannot let go of things, some people collect animals to the degree of which, you know, they may have 50, 60, 70 dogs or cats or in some cases other species of animals. And in these situations, these people, albeit are very well-intended and well-meaning, and they think they are rescuing the animals, but they don't have the capacity either monetarily or physically or emotionally to care for these animals. So these animals are basically in a very poor state of care. And the homes, in many cases, basically have to be condemned because of the lack of animal care and the... And, you know, there's feces everywhere, and in fact, some animals die in the home and the owners aren't aware. It's an area in which my colleague from the counseling center says is very underprescribed as far as research is concerned, and it's very hard to get funding for, but it's an area that we do need to look at.
Yeah, but on the other side, there's another form of collection, if you like. It's not, I wouldn't call hoarding, but I think in Canada there's a sort of a rare breeds association. The chair of that used to be Tom Hutchinson, who was a professor at Trent University. He collected pigs. But he had two of all the species of pigs that had ever sort of been extant in Canada, because his idea was that the current production of pigs and cows and all the other domestic animals that we use is getting such a small genetic pool that he thinks that we need places where people hoard the old breeds.
Hopefully that's not a case of hoarding as much as genetic preservation, and that is certainly, you are correct, that is certainly a concern for all of our agricultural species, whether it be poultry. I don't know much about the beef industry, but the swine industry, yes, and the poultry industry for sure.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. We're talking with Gaylene Fasenko, who's from the Agricultural College at New Mexico State University, and we're talking about companion animals. We'll be back in one brief moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Polio, which plagued humans for thousands of years, is on the verge of being wiped out.
Compared with 1988, when the virus was found in 125 countries, today it's only in three: Nigeria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. But they pose stiff challenges.
In these countries, logistics and politics are blocking the elimination of polio, and the lack of money makes the effort even tougher.
The main problem is getting the vaccines to children in remote areas, which is complicated by geopolitics, much of which is anti-U.S. The Taliban banned the vaccinations in northern Pakistan to protest American drone strikes. Elsewhere in Pakistan, a community worker with the anti-polio campaign was shot and killed.
What's driving some of the violence is a distrust of humanitarian workers. A polio vaccine program in Nigeria was undermined by rumors that the vaccine is unsafe and part of a plan to sterilize Muslim children.
Exacerbating the distrust was the CIA's fake vaccination campaign to locate Osama bin Laden. They plan to use DNA obtained by administering a hepatitis B vaccine to identify bin Laden's children and thus find the terrorist. Revelation of the ruse enraged locals and put healthcare workers at risk.
These polio-endemic countries continue to place polio-free countries at risk for imported cases. An outbreak in China in early 2012 paralyzed 17 children, killed two, and may have come from Pakistan.
Sadly, they were avoidable with a vaccine that cost just 50 cents a dose. A valiant effort by multiple nonprofits and government agencies is now underway to rid the last vestiges of this disease. Let's hope this time it works.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Gaylene Fasenko talking about companion animals.
How did the dog get domesticated? You know, there's stories that they were once wolves, and I remember seeing in Lascaux in a cave, people 5,000 years old, that they actually had pictures of domesticated dogs that they painted on the walls of the caves.
Oh, that's a great question. That's certainly something that I talk about in one of my classes. There's a couple of theories, and certainly we can't project ourselves back. The current theory is that dogs were domesticated approximately 15,000 years ago. And of all the species we have, including our domesticated farm animals, dogs were the first to be domesticated. So it should not come as any surprise to people that we have a special affinity in our heart for these animals. The theories behind how dogs were domesticated are several. Some people think that humans actually literally are first hunter and gatherers that started settling down in camps, started domesticating these animals. So they would go out and they would find wolf pups, because dogs, all dogs, whether you're a pug, whether you're a chihuahua, whether you're a Great Dane, your ancestor is the Eurasian gray wolf. And when you look at the variety of our dog species, it's hard to imagine that a chihuahua has evolved from a wolf, but that is the case. The theories behind the domestication are several, and I always tell my students to keep an open mind that as new discoveries are being made, especially new archaeological discoveries, our views on domestication and how animals were domesticated may change, but there's currently two theories, and the first is that humans actively selected animals. They would get wolf pups and they would raise them, and the ones that were tamer and calmer were then bred to other tame and calm wolves. And then the other theory is that wolves may have partially domesticated themselves. As our hunter-gatherer ancestors settled down in camps and started making more permanent settlements, we had human garbage, whether it be bones from the other animals we ate, whether it be a nice warm fire, whether it be shelter. And the tamer of wolves started hanging around these camps because it was a fairly easy source of food for them. And so these tamer wolves started hanging around, and the more they hung around, the wolves that were tamer were able to eat better and were able to reproduce more effectively. And
had a competitive advantage.
They had a competitive advantage. There was more, because we know that one of the first systems that an animal will abandon, if you will, if they are undernourished, is reproduction. They will not reproduce. Most species will not reproduce if they are undernourished. You have to be a fit animal to be able to reproduce. So these animals had a competitive advantage. And so those are the two theories behind how wolves started to become domesticated.
I would recommend our listeners to read this book, White Fang. I mean, that's a very beautiful illustration of a wild wolf and how it becomes associated with humans who use it both positively and negatively. And it's a great description of how domestication can, in fact, take place.
Right. Now, domestication, as I tell my students, is a process. It is not taking a wild wolf from the wild and taming it. Our domesticated dogs, as I said, have been domesticated for 15,000 years. So to try and relate wolf behavior and dog behavior today is really erroneous, because our dogs are very, very different than wolves.
Let's talk about the impact of humans, because, I mean, there's a lot of bad breeding habits. I used to breed Afghan hounds. Well, my wife and I did. And we gave it up after a few years because there was something not correct about it. So many of these animals got hip dysplasia, and it just seemed to me that there was no controlling legal authority that made the breeding process as good as it should be. And, of course, talk a little bit about the sort of negative impact of humans and breeding animals, dogs in particular.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we have not done some of our breeds a very good service. I love all the breeds of dogs that we have, but many of them have health issues that have been perpetuated by humans. And the main reason is once we started showing dogs, and I'm not knocking the dog show world by any stretch of the imagination, but people with certain breeds wanted a certain look. And one of the breeds that I often use as an example is the bulldog. Many years ago, the bulldogs were more of a healthy breed, and then people decided, you know what, we like a bigger head on the bulldog. That's what a bulldog is meant to look like. So they started breeding for form, for looks, rather than function. And that's when we started getting in trouble. So right now, bulldogs have very large heads. They're bred for very large heads, very narrow hindquarters, and one of the things that has resulted in is that they can no longer breed effectively naturally, and they certainly cannot have their puppies or whelp naturally. So all bulldogs pretty much have to be cesarean sectioned. They cannot whelp their puppies naturally. And with that breed and with selecting for a particular skull shape, which is called a brachycephalic skull shape, so the dogs that have the pushed-in noses, certainly in our area of the country where we have very hot summers, we have to be very careful with those breeds because they have a very hard time with heat exhaustion. They can't dissipate heat well. They have a hard time breathing. They tend to be snorers because of their nasal passages, their shortened nasal passages. So in many of the breeds, we have not done them a good service.
So we're breeding them into extinction, effectively, which is an interesting concept.
If we didn't have human intervention, we would be breeding them into extinction.
Yeah, some of the societies that are in the shows are really working against that right now.
Yes, and in fact, I was in Sweden a few years ago, and their Swedish Kennel Club is working in conjunction with the dog show world. So the veterinarians, the Swedish Kennel Club, and the dog show people have come to an agreement that we have gone too far with some of these breeds, and we have to start reverting back to breeding for health rather than form. One of the difficulties is that if you don't change the breed standard, when someone goes to a dog show and they are showing a dog that is outside the breed standard, if they're breeding for health rather than looks, their dog's not going to win. And so we have to change a whole philosophy about what is appropriate for a particular breed.
So they should give prizes for the ability to reproduce, to run 100 yards in 7 seconds. And I mean, there's going to be a whole different way of having dog shows.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of ironic that this breed can no longer whelp naturally, because the original purpose for dog shows was to show off your breeding stock to other people and say, look, I've got a really great-looking female. You've got a really great-looking male. They're great dogs. Let's breed them together. And so the whole purpose originally for dog shows was to get together with other dog enthusiasts and to show off your breeding stock.
Absolutely. Well, now let's change topics a little bit, but carrying on with, I think, dogs or animals in general. But the whole utilization now of animals to detect disease in people. I mean, I know that there are companion dogs that are being sort of trained by smell to distinguish a healthy odor from their owner from an unhealthy odor. Could you go into that little area for us, please?
Absolutely. Well, dogs have amazing noses. And I was in my daughter's fifth grade class talking about this yesterday. We are woefully pathetic as human beings when it comes to our sense of smell. Our dominant sense tends to be our sight. And so when we look at a desk, I was showing the students a picture yesterday of a messy desk. And I said, when I tell you, find the food on the desk, all the kids said, well, I'm looking for it, and that's exactly what, right. They look for it. We see it with our eyes. When dogs look for something, their dominant sense is their nose. And we have about 5 million, as human beings, we have about 5 million receptors in our nose that we use to detect certain smells. And that seems rather impressive until you mention that dogs have about 220 million olfactory receptors. And so they have been bred over numerous years to perform this role for humans, to seek out things. And one of the areas that we're now using them for is for disease. In fact, I have a young lady at the university who I know who has a diabetes detection dog, and she was recently featured in a magazine in Las Cruces, her and her dog Merlin, Amelia. He helps her detect when her blood sugar is low.
And that is for the production of, is it acetone? I mean, it's a particular chemical then that is part of the excretion process of a diabetic person. Is that the way it works?
Yes, exactly.
And what other diseases do you know that are I mean, I've read somewhere that they
can
either
detect
cancer.
Yes.
That's exactly. I don't know what type of cancer.
Yes, and you know, I think people need to recognize, you know, when they hear that dogs are being used to detect disease, that shouldn't replace, and under no circumstances should we think it should replace modern medicine. Dogs' noses can be used as a tool in the toolbox. So in addition to the technology we have for modern medicine, you know, some dermatologists have been getting pretty frustrated. I know there was a story of a dermatologist in Florida who is very frustrated with the fact that he had a hard time with the modern tools available to him to detect very early stages of skin cancer. And, of course, we know that the earlier you can detect cancer, the better the prognosis for treatment and effective treatment. And so he was reading a story about a dog that was detecting, I believe it was explosives, and decided that he wanted to try using this to detect skin cancer. And so they're using dogs now to train to detect for skin cancer, lung cancer, bladder cancer, any sort of cancer in which you can detect cells readily.
So, I mean, how does that going to work? Do you think that we're going to walk into the doctor's office and before you actually, just after you've given up the credit card, then you pass the dogs and then you go into the waiting room and then the doctor sees, well, what were the response of the dogs?
Dog leads you into the right room.
You know, we joke about it, and it does seem very unreal and just
no, not at
crazy.
All. I think it doesn't sound so unreal. I mean, look, you train dogs to seek out drugs, and they're incredibly effective. So I'm not facetious about this at all. I think this is a really positive.
Well, it is a very positive thing, and in my estimation, I think. But it does sound a little crazy, you know. But it is, as I mentioned, is as a scientist, as someone who seeks out knowledge and truth, and hopefully the medical community will open up in the future their ideas of using some of these tools in the toolbox in addition to the current techniques that we have.
We're running out of time, and I have one question that's been on my mind. There are other companion animals like elephants that do remarkable things. Do you have any comments about elephants?
I have never heard of elephants being referred to as companion animals. Certainly there are people that have snakes and lizards and birds.
No, it's in the Indian tradition where they really have these personal relationships with their elephants that are very similar to the relations we have with dogs and cats.
Well, the kennels are a little bit bigger, I suspect.
Yes.
Certainly that kind of bond would be an extremely strong bond if you had that elephant from it being a youngster, because of course they have such long lives that it would forge a very strong bond.
And one of the most holy of all the gods, Ganesh, in the Indian Hindu tradition, is in fact the elephant.
Yeah.
And most homes of Indian people that I've ever been to, somewhere they will have an image of Ganesh. And so Russ is probably right. It's not just a companion, but it's a companion for life and spirit, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, look, we come to the end of another informative Science Studio program. And Gaylene, thank you so much up there in Las Cruces. And
we're very glad that this time in Science Studio we had Gaylene Fasenko. She's on the faculty of the Department of Animal and Range Sciences at the New Mexico State University.
So, Gaylene, thank you very much. Thank you, Norma Martinez, as usual, for putting the program together. And thank you, the listener, for making this possible. Take care. Bye-bye.